Okay. So welcome to the Shabbat Bible study on the 1st of July, 2017. We are in Leviticus. It's great to see all your faces and know that you're still coming. Okay, so today's section is Leviticus 5 and Zechariah 5:3. Until 6:15. And let's start with some prayer. Lord, thank you so much for bringing us all here this Shabbat, and we ask for your blessing on this morning, that you would meet us and help us understand more your word, especially these chapters in Leviticus and Zechariah that aren't so clear all the time. And I pray you give each one something that would spur them on in their walk with you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
So we have some interesting stuff this morning. Boker Tov. What we'll do, as our habit is read through. I have to say that the numbering of the verses is slightly different between the Hebrew Bible and the English Bible in our little section. So Leviticus 5 in Hebrew, in English, stops earlier than in Hebrew. So there's an eight verse difference. So we're going to follow the Hebrew. So that means we'll read, if you're reading in English, we'll read up to chapter 6 until the 8th verse. Okay, so why don't we begin? Gemma, you want to start us off?
Chapter 5,
verse 1.
If anyone sins because they don't speak up when they hear a public charge to testify regarding something they've seen or learned about, they'll be held responsible. If anyone becomes aware that they are guilty, if they unwittingly touch anything ceremonially unclean, whether the carcass of an unclean animal, wild or domestic, or of any unclean creature that moves along the ground, and they're unaware that they've become unclean, that then they come to realize their guilt, or if they touch human uncleanliness, anything that would make them unclean, even though they're unaware of it, that then they learn of it and realize their guilt, or if anyone thoughtlessly takes an oath to do anything, whether good or evil, in any manner one might carelessly swear about, even though they're unaware of it, that then they learn of it and realize their guilt. When anyone becomes aware that they are guilty in any of these matters, they must confess in what way they have sinned. As a penalty for sin they have committed, they must bring to the Lord a female lamb or goat from the flock as a sin offering, and the priest shall make atonement for them for their sin.
All right.
If he cannot afford a lamb, he is to bring two doves or two young pigeons to the Lord as a penalty for his sin, one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering. He is to bring them to the priest, who shall first offer the one for the sin offering. He is to wring its head from its neck, not severing it completely, and is to sprinkle some of the blood of the sin offering against the side of the altar. The rest of the blood must be drained out at the base of the altar. It is a sin offering. The priest shall then offer the other as a burnt offering in the prescribed way and make atonement for him for the sin he has committed, and he will be forgiven.
But if his means are insufficient, even for two doves or two young pigeons, then he is to bring as his offering for the sin he committed two quarts of fine flour for a sin offering. He is not to put any olive oil or frankincense on it, because it is a sin offering. He is to bring it to the Kohen, and the Kohen is to take a handful of it as its reminder portion and make it go up in smoke on the altar, on top of the offerings for Adonai made by fire. It is a sin offering. Thus the Kohen will make atonement for him in regard to the sin he committed concerning any of these things, and he will be forgiven. The rest will belong to the
see, verse 19 or 20. Who's reading next? Maybe Joe? In English, it's the end of 5. In Hebrew, it's not.
Okay.
So 5:20 in Hebrew is 6:1 in English.
So you need one. So
6.
6:1, yeah. So that's our section.
So where did you read to in 6?
To verse 8, or to verse through to the end of verse 7, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
So in Hebrew, chapter
yeah,
6 starts
it.
With English, verse 8. Don't worry, in chapter 7, it goes back to the same. It's like
that's
they took
okay.
a little...
What was the reason for this? You know?
I don't know. I'm sure some manuscript somewhere was different and one tradition went with one and the other not. It's interesting that the NET Bible does, it explains there's a difference, but it doesn't say why.
The interesting thing is that the real parasha starts at 6:8.
Well, there is...
If one was doing the regular annual parasha.
There have always been... markers in the Hebrew text of tuha and stuma, like little paragraph breaks. There's a shorter, there's a half line break, and then there's a paragraph break that are written into the manuscripts.
Right.
You know, you find them in the Dead Sea Scrolls as well. And so those kind of chunk out sections in the Bible. And so the parashot will pay attention to those paragraph markings. But whether you call that chunk chapter 6, 1 to 8, or chapter 5, 20 to 28, I don't know why. That seems a later thing. But for our purposes, we'll just take it as it is. All right. So we start off with the case of a person who would sin by hearing the voice of an Allah. Allah. What is an Allah?
Not a curse.
Is what?
Curse.
It has been translated curse, and that could be a valid translation in some contexts. I'm not sure it always has to be a curse, though. But it is something spoken. It's once you speak it, it's almost like it's tangible.
Which is the word Allah in English?
Allah in English would be the word, when a person sins and that he hears a public curse.
Oh, public charge, I've got.
Public charge.
Right.
Okay, in Hebrew it says, he hears the voice of an Allah, and he's a witness. Or he saw, or he knew. And if he doesn't say something, he carries his iniquity. Apparently. So the NET Bible tries to fill in. If he is a witness, he either saw or knew what had happened, and he does not make it known. But what they add an interesting line. When a person sins and that he hears a public curse against one who fails to testify, and he is a witness. So that is a little confusing to me.
By being adjured to testify.
Yeah, so... So it's a little confusing because it doesn't spell everything out completely. But there is a spoken oath involved that's public, so that public in the sense of other, it wasn't spoken to yourself in a little room. It's something other people have heard. So I want to help us understand what Allah means by looking at some other places in the Bible where it appears. There are 32 times it appears. We're not going to look at all of them, but we can look at a couple. And we'll start with Genesis 24. What's going on in Genesis 24? Come on, guys. It's like one of the longest love stories in the Bible. Rivka. It's a story of Isaac needing a wife, and Abraham sending his servant to go get a wife, and then Rivka is that miraculous provision. So in chapter 24 of Genesis, verse 41, our word Allah comes. So we can turn to Genesis 24, 41, but we'll probably go back a couple verses. Let's try. Okay. So this is Abraham's trusted slave, like the guy in charge of everything in his household. And he's sending him off to find a wife back home in Aram, Naharaim. And so the servant says, I'm reading from 39. What if the woman, he's repeating what a conversation he had with Abraham before he left. What if the woman does not want to go with me? Is not willing to go with me? He answered, the Lord before whom I have walked will send his angel with you. He will make your journey a success, and you will find a wife for my son from among my relatives, from my father's family. You will be free from your oath if you go to my relatives, and they will not give her to you. Then you will be free from your oath. So that word oath there is the word Allah.
It says from your oath or from my oath?
Yeah, it's interesting. Here it says your oath, but in Hebrew it actually says my oath.
Yeah, I've got my oath in the NIV.
Okay. And so the NET Bible points out that in the Hebrew perspective, the oath belongs to the person to whom it was sworn. So if the servant swears to Abraham, it's like his oath is hovering around Abraham. But from our perspective, the person making the oath is the one responsible for it.
Just say it again. The oath belongs to the person to whom it was sworn.
So if I make an oath about you, my oath is like on you.
Right.
As opposed to being on me. It's like my word goes out and sits on you.
Right.
And that's the interesting concept here, that the word, this oath, is like alive in the sense that it goes somewhere and it sits there.
And there's that famous verse.
There's a couple of them.
Well, the one I'm thinking of suddenly is God swears an oath on himself because there's none higher than us.
Sure. Okay, and so then there's different words for swearing an oath, and I'm certainly not an expert, but
right.
It is interesting that some of these concepts come together.
Right.
You have the verb lihishava, to swear,
right,
on something, and shvu'a is the swearing. That's typically translated oath. So shvu'a and Allah often come together. And then the other one, Shvu'a, Allah, give me the other one.
Brit,
yeah. So a covenant. The Allah is often connected to a covenant. So we're going to look at this in a minute, but when ancient cultures made agreements between two kings, call them vassal treaties. There was a bigger king and a lesser king. And the bigger king usually protected and sent help to the lesser king if the lesser king was faithful and paid a certain amount of taxes and stayed on the side of the bigger king. And at the end of these agreements, they would have all these alot and shvuot. They'd have all kinds of curses. If you break the covenant, this is what's going to come on you. And it's kind of a binding pact, you could say. Use the word pact.
It's so powerful, Sharon.
Yeah.
I mean, when God makes an oath, when he makes covenants, he is making a binding pact.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes he's taking it on himself, and other times he's putting it on, this is my covenant, this is my promise with you.
Well, yeah, he's always taking it on himself in the sense the foundation is God and his character. But there are also consequences. Like, the whole book of Deuteronomy is written like one big covenant pact.
Right.
And so at the end of the book, you have chapters 28, 29, all about what's going to happen if you break the covenant with God. And it's got some serious alot there.
It's written like a contract.
It's written like a contract between kings.
Or like a treaty.
And so it kind of makes people understand their relationship with God the same way they would understand it with a big king and a little king. Which, by the way, only in the Bible do we have this. Never elsewhere, these kind of covenants were always between people, never with a God. So it was really like a new perspective for Deuteronomy to say, hey, your relationship with God is just like in the political sphere with this big king and little king. And you owe him allegiance. If you break his covenant, these are the consequences. All these curses are going to come on you. If you don't break the covenant, you're staying in his blessing, and all these blessings will come on you. So they have blessings and curses. Now, in the older laws, in the Hittite kingdom, they had these kind of covenants, and there were like a few curses at the end if you break the law. The Assyrians, they were like harsh people. They took it to a new level of curses. And all the Assyrian treaties between kings, they have just like paragraphs and paragraphs of curses, really serious stuff. So in the book of Deuteronomy, you kind of see a mix of a Hittite treaty, or something that resembles a Hittite pattern, and something that resembles the Assyrian, where, hey, take this seriously, because these are all these huge, serious curses if you don't do this covenant. So it is interesting here, if you look at verse 41, as tinake me'alati, you will be cleaned from my oath if this and this happens. Vehayita naki me'alati, you will be clean of my Allah. So it's interesting because now it confuses me where the Allah is actually sitting. If it's on the servant or on Abraham.
Maybe it's because Abraham made him swear. He can say
it's my oath. Yeah. Yeah, maybe.
Because then in later passages you see something similar. It is my oath or his oath, which talks about God, but it's on the people and it has an effect on him. So maybe it's he that initiates the oath, but then the people that actually swear.
Uh-huh.
So maybe also here it's he, Abram, who initiates, but the servant who actually
swears,
because that's what he does. He does the swearing.
Right. So if the oath is broken, it's like it falls on the servant. But
I think that there's an ancient relationship going on, which is very foreign to our modern years.
Well, for sure.
I think in the past, when you are a servant of somebody, you do whatever he says. There's no questioning about it, and you know he's your leader. So if he does not fulfill his word, then the curses come on you. So you better, you know, live up to what he said. So, I mean, with our today's maybe very individualistic thinking, so why? I didn't make this. So I'm free.
Okay, sure.
You know, that kind of.
For sure, that's part of it. We don't live in a world with this kind of slavery and what that means in like total obedience and that kind of thing, or oaths for that matter. At least not in the Western world.
What can you say is that if The man who makes the oath, in this case it was Abraham, right?
Mm-hmm.
He makes the oath and he puts it on the... He swears that this is what you're to do, and the guy doesn't do it or doesn't do it. I'm not clear about where the curse comes in.
Okay, well, here's the interesting thing.
Swear. He doesn't swear himself. He makes him swear.
If
you...
You're to swear. You're to
he
swear
asked a question. Back in Genesis 24, verse 5, the servant asked him, what if the woman's not willing to come back with me? Should I then take your son back to the land he came from? And Abram says, you know, by no means. The same God who brought me out, you know, is going to make her willing. So then look at verse 8, 24 verse 8. And if she's not willing to come after you, and you will be clean from my shvu'ah, my oath. So it uses this word for oath there. Just under no circumstances take my son back to my homeland. And so, what does the servant do? The servant placed his hand under the thigh of his master Abraham and gave his solemn promise he would carry out his wishes. Okay?
Yeah.
Vayasam ha'eved et yado tahat yerech Avraham Adonav. Vayishavalo al hadavar hazeh. So he swears
this word.
So the word Allah doesn't occur in this first instance, but in the servant's recap of what happened, he uses this word Allah as like a binding pact. And it is pretty serious. If you recognize thigh, it's a euphemism. So if you put your hand under someone's thigh, you're in a very private area. And an area involved with procreation and fundamental, you could say fundamental identity, in the sense that it like represents all your descendants. So this is a pretty serious oath. And there's that sense that you can be cleaned from it if someone does something.
Yeah, and I'm reading all the, you know, I'm doing a search with the word Allah.
Uh-huh.
It comes up all this in different passages. It appears to me, at the first glance at least, is that there is a lot of curses attached to this.
Yes.
There's no blessings. It's not like if you do this, you're going to be blessed.
Mm-hmm.
No. It's like more of like, if you don't do this, then...
Right, this is what's going to happen.
Gonna, so...
Which is why functionally it's translated as curse.
Yeah. So I'm thinking, you know, I'm not sure, but then the servant Eliezer, when he took this oath, the Shivua, with the Shivua comes attached this Allah, which also means if he does not fulfill his part of the bargain or what his role is, then there's going to be certain curses. So he wants to be free of that. He doesn't want the curses. I mean, he wants to be obedient, but he doesn't want... You know,
now,
does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
It does make sense. I mean, the interesting thing is, how would he have been free of it if the woman had refused to go with him?
Yeah, it's not his
then
fault.
Then he's free. Then it's not his fault,
not his
and he's
fault.
Free.
Yeah.
And if, by any chance, he'd taken Isaac back with him...
Then he would be guilty.
Then he'd be guilty, and again the curse would fall on him. So it's a double thing. He basically is making two promises, isn't he? One is to...
Sort of. Well, there's two outcomes to the promise.
Yeah, two outcomes.
Look quickly, because we don't have a ton of time for each section, but Genesis 26, 25, we're in the context of Isaac, who stays in Gerar, in Philistine country, and everyone is kind of afraid of him because they recognize God's with him. And if you look at verse 28, we could plainly see that the Lord is with you, so we decided there should be a pact between us and you. Allow us to make a treaty with you so that you will not do us any harm, just as we have not harmed you, but have always treated you well before sending you away in peace. Now you are blessed by the Lord. So where's our word? Tehi na Allah benotenu. Let there be a pact between us. That's this word Allah. So here it sounds a little bit more neutral. But it's still, you're right in saying it's still that idea of this is a pact. If you break it, there's going to be a negative consequence on you.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really emphasize if you keep it, you're going to be blessed. But it does say we recognize you're blessed, so we kind of want to have a pact with you. So there could be a hint of a blessing there. Mm-hmm. Like, as long as we're friends, your blessing might extend to us.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's at least neutral. You know, we're not. It's not going to be negative.
But I can also see that if you break your word, then you're going to be cursed as a result of this pact.
So we've seen two contexts in Genesis where this word Allah is used. Now, there's a famous one in Numbers 5, that strange ceremony of the husband who suspects his wife. He has a jealous spirit. Okay, so in Numbers 5, verses 21, 23, and 27, we have an Allah. Allah. Okay. And in this context, I think everybody translates curse. But let's just keep it binding oath. So the priest is going to write these oaths on a scroll in some type of ink and something, and then he's going to wash it off into water, and the woman's going to drink it. And if she actually did something, like if she actually did break her loyalty, then all those oaths would take effect on her body. But if she's innocent, they won't take any effect. So, by the way, the interesting thing with this rite in the Bible is that we found similar rites in the ancient Near East. And when someone was jealous, they actually mixed in a little bit of poison that, you know, probably, I don't know the exact percentage, but let's say 30% of the time the person would be hurt and 70% they'd be okay. So it was just kind of like, well, maybe you'll come out okay. In this case, all the ingredients are neutral. So it really would be just a divine intervention. If she did get sick, it would be a sign of divine punishment. It would not be caused from the ink or the poison that she ate, which is more fair for the woman. Okay. Okay, so, but notice also the it's called bitterness. This water is bitter water. And it, it's interesting because the concept of bitterness is linked to rebellion in the Bible. And so if she has broken her covenant, the bitter waters will have an effect. And again, she will be clean. If she was faithful, if you look at verse 28, if she was faithful and pure, she will be clean. And the implication is her fertility won't be affected. So part of the curse here seems to be that she would be infertile, or maybe she would lose the baby if she had conceived a baby with somebody else. All kinds of speculation what a swollen abdomen and all of that meant. Okay, so for our purposes, there's this real thing. Once you speak the word or write the word, it's like something is sitting on you, waiting to see if you do this or that, and it will have a real effect on you. That's this concept of Allah. And then, of course, we've been talking about the law this whole time. So look at Deuteronomy 29, 11, 13, and 18. And this understanding Deuteronomy is really key, or understanding this concept of Deuteronomy is key for all the prophets. It's key for understanding the exile, for understanding any type of bad consequence on the nation of Israel. Okay, so in 11, it mentions the Brit Adonai, the covenant of the Lord your God, and his pact, or his oath. Uve'alato, asher Adonai Elohecha koret imcha hayom. So here they're equating, in this verse it's actually equating Allah and Brit, a covenant, and it's using the word koret. You cut a covenant. This is the technical lingo used for covenants. And it's using the same verb applies to both this and that. So there's a strong connection, like Joe mentioned earlier, with covenant.
Can we have the verse again?
11. Deuteronomy 29:11.
I think it's 12 in English, possibly.
Oh, it could possibly 12 in English? Sorry. Yeah, it's 12 in English. And then again in 13, which probably is 14 in English. Because God specifies, I'm not just making this covenant with you, but this Allah is going to be on all your descendants as well.
I'm lost. Oh,
why
sorry.
Are you lost?
Just chapter and verse. Deuteronomy.
29.
Deuteronomy
sorry.
Chapter 9.
No. 29.
Okay, I'm not so. I am lost. Totally.
29, verse 12
okay.
In English.
Okay, I'm all right.
Yeah, you got it highlighted. There you go. You're found. 29:11, which is English 12, and 13, which is English 14. It is not with you alone that I'm making this covenant by oath. So here, it's kind of a ratifying the covenant. I don't know, it could be neutral, but we know that to break the covenant has bad consequences. But I'm not sure God would call his own covenant a curse. That's why I hesitate to call on Allah a curse directly. But certainly when you look at the practical implications, what you're worried about is the curses or the evil consequences that would come on you for breaking a covenant. And then look importantly in verse 18, which I guess would be, what would that be in English? 19? Okay. And 17. It says, beware if there's somebody from among you that listens to this and has a root of bitterness. And it comes when he hears the words of this Allah and he blesses himself in his heart, that means he says to himself, it's going to be fine with me and I can just do whatever I want because the watered ground will be enough for the thirsty. And the idea is all those people keeping the law are going to cover me. I can just do what I want. And I'm part of the community, it doesn't matter. And God says, and when he hears these things, okay, sorry. God will not be willing to forgive him, and his jealous anger will burn against him. If you go read the chapter in Acts 8 about Simon the sorcerer, remember, Peter says, I see a bitter root in you, and pray to God that he would be willing to forgive you. And we all think, like, well, why won't God be willing to forgive him? It's all about this covenant, because God says he will not be willing to forgive that person. So what Peter is saying to Simon the sorcerer is you're breaking the covenant by wanting the power apart from God. You're going against his covenant, and therefore you better get it together, or God won't be willing to forgive you.
What is that word in verse 19? Though you fail the mice?
It's a word for being willing. He won't be willing to forgive you. So, in other words, take this very, very, very seriously. And then, you know, if you continue that direction, he's going to wipe you out from under the heaven. Now on the flip side, in Deuteronomy 30, verse 7, all these same curses, if you do obey God's covenant, all these curses are going to fall on your enemies instead.
Well, that's nice.
That's nice to know. Ooh, they can be lifted up and it's the hot potato. But it's this idea of permanence, once this word is uttered, it's out there, and it's sitting there. And I think it's kind of a different idea than we have. We just think words are words. They can be changed. Doesn't matter. But this concept is more like once this word is uttered, it's like born into existence. And now there's this little word out there, and it's going to have an effect one way or another.
I word will not return to me void.
Well, yeah, it could be that same concept of the importance of words. So, okay, we got a little bit. If you look at 1 Kings 8:31, okay. In English it says, when someone is accused of sinning against his neighbor and the latter pronounces a curse on the alleged offender before your altar in this temple, be willing to forgive the accused if the accusation is false. So again, this gets confusing. Who is accusing who of sinning, and then who is cursing at the altar? Okay. But again, it's using the same Allah. And if you were reading it in Hebrew in verse 31, it says, actually doesn't say, okay, in English, and the latter pronounces a curse on the alleged offender before your altar in this temple. In Hebrew, it doesn't say the person actually goes to the temple. The Allah goes to the temple. Mm-hmm. Uva Allah lifne mizbahacha babay tazeh. So that's interesting. So again, it's as if this spoken word, this spoken entity, is fluttering over to the temple. And I guess that's where God makes a just judgment. And either it's dissipated or it's true. So Isaiah 24:6 we'll look at. Okay, well, that's a nice little translation I have. I'll go back to verse 5 as you're turning there. Isaiah 24, verse 5. The earth is defiled by its inhabitants, for they have violated laws, disregarded the regulation, and broken the permanent treaty. So a treaty curse devours the earth. That's how they've translated Allah here in verse 6. So that kind of ties back to our Deuteronomy 29. These treaty oaths that are violated, and so there's evil consequences. Okay. And it also mentions being guilty here in verse 6. Its inhabitants pay for their guilt or suffer the consequences for guilt. Or in Hebrew, it just says, will be guilty. So there's some interpretation, as there is in our original text in Leviticus 5.
It's interesting that it says, like, change the ordinance and broken the everlasting covenant. Like, how do you break a covenant that's everlasting? Like, either it's everlasting or it's not.
Right.
And how do you change it?
Brit Olam, yeah. Well, maybe it was meant to be everlasting, and so then when you break it, it's that much worse. It's certainly everlasting on God's part. On people's part, not so much.
Could it be Brit Olam in the sense of for all generations? So not just for two people, but sort of...
Certainly. I mean, the one we read in 29 specifically says it's not just with you,
right.
It's all your descendants.
So it's broken down until it resumes again later?
Well, here's the thing. It's broken on one side. And so God has a choice to either destroy you or to give you another chance. Just like if you're married and your husband or wife commits adultery.
It's broken right now.
It's broken. They broke it. You didn't. you have the choice. You could forgive them, or you could get a divorce.
Or you
right?
could forgive them and get a divorce.
Okay.
But the principle is the right principle. When God makes an everlasting brit, covenant,
mm-hmm.
and that nothing changes. And we break it in many ways.
Exactly.
And then the only way to do it is either to repent and go back, which is really where we're back in Leviticus, because that's
yeah.
when you've done something, you have to go back and apologize for your guilt, even if you didn't intend to. I mean,
and not just apologize, but actually make up for
and
it.
Make up restitution.
Physically or, yeah.
There has to be restitution, yeah.
Is this
yeah.
the Brit Olam from Genesis 9?
The Brit Olam was, we were talking about from Isaiah.
I know.
But certainly it could
refer
back to that. I don't know, I haven't looked how many times Brit Olam comes. If it only appeared in Genesis 9, I'd say for sure Isaiah would be going back there. And he might be thinking of that anyway, because Isaiah was amazing. if you look in Proverbs 29:24, we have a similar context to what we started reading in Leviticus 5. Whoever shares with a thief is his own enemy. He hears the oath to testify, but does not talk. In Hebrew, cholek im ganav sone nafsho. He hates his own soul. Ala yishma velo yagid. He hears an oath, but doesn't speak. And again, we have this idea that because he's not speaking up, he carries his own guilt. That's the idea of Leviticus 5. So it still isn't clear to me exactly who cursed. Maybe the victim cursed someone, cursed the perpetrator, and you were a witness, so you could verify whether it was true or not.
So then the alleged victim curses.
Well, right, or what if you're supposed to say they did do that, if they did do it?
Okay.
I don't know, it's confusing to me. Maybe it's both.
But in modern human terms, people lie under oath. They lie under testimony. They give fake reports. They say, yes, 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 my wife was at home, my husband was at home all night, when actually he was out doing quite nasty things.
Right.
And I mean, then the consequence of that lie comes on them.
Or if there is a victim and someone saw what happened but refuses to testify, and then the victim curses them because, you know, you're the only one who can put this person in jail and you're not talking.
Mm.
The translation here, David Stern has, the accomplice of a thief hates
mm-hmm.
himself. He hears himself put under oath but discloses. Within itself, that makes sense, but
mm-hmm.
that he's refusing to give testimony against the guy he was helping.
Right, so who's making the oath? He's making the oath?
I'm not sure. He's put under oath, so I guess someone comes and says, tell us what happened.
Allah yishma. It's this Allah. He hears an Allah, but doesn't say it. We are in Proverbs 29:24. It's kind of a cryptic statement, but it seems to have behind it the same situation as Leviticus 5. In the context of figuring out who's innocent and guilty, there's a legal testifying going on. And it's very crucial. If you're a witness, you need to be a witness. Say the right thing. There are more alot. I don't know. It doesn't look like we have time for them. But in Daniel 9:11, you can look later, Nehemiah 10:30, and 2 Chronicles 6:22, we have this same idea of this utterance of this curse that's almost like it's a living thing. And it comes to the temple in 2 Chronicles 6:22. So it's kind of like it's like sitting on you or waiting to see the result.
Sure, I understood. Because sometimes, like in Daniel 9,
Yeah.
If I understand correctly, they're kind of overlapping things.
Yeah.
Shuvla is more speaking more of, I don't know, solidarity, whereas Allah brings in this connotation of trouble if you break it.
It seems to be. They're both, I mean, sometimes they seem identical. They're both words for oath, like oath and pact. What's the difference?
Sharon, is there any communication of, like, if God's name is invoked?
A couple of contexts, there could be. I mean, another way of making an oath is to say, by whatever God you serve, right? Where, you know the expression in English, by Jove, if you've ever read Asterix. By Jove. Jove was a god.
Or if you're British.
Or if you're British. You know, by Jove?
Do.
It's really...
Do Brits still pray to Jove?
I fear they might do.
It's that Roman influence from way back when.
They've just come. They maybe just arrived. I'll tell you the up-to-date gods.
But the idea is when you want to say, what I'm saying is really true, you know, you may not have seen it, but that God saw it, you know, by... His name, or like you're invoking God's name for his power. It is often you're swearing by a God's name, so they are connected, I would say. They're not explicitly mentioned that every oath you take is in God's name.
In British justice, yes, you do swear an oath. What's the official line? You put your hand up, and what do you say?
You can take the oath.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know, but what is the actual wording of the oath?
By
Almighty God. Yeah, you do. I swear by Almighty God to tell the truth,
the
whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
You hold the Bible.
And you hold the Bible. Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing to me is that this concept of this oath and a witness is being connected in Leviticus to something ceremonial that isn't in the same moral sphere.
Yeah.
And it's weird that here they are in the same chunk together.
Somehow it affects God in all these cases. So if you say that there's an oath in which he pronounced the name of God, for example,
mm-hmm.
you might say that is the trouble, the Hashem, the guilt of thing.
Yes, he's Hashem.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay, yeah, because whether he knows it or not, he has become impure and guilty. But I think in chapter 5 that we read, it's probably, you have the word of confession and this sense of realizing your guilt. This is probably the best picture, I'd say, we have of someone confessing or repenting, is really realizing that you're guilty and wanting to come back to God. So it's interesting because your translation, some translations talk about becoming guilty as a legal thing, like, oh, you've been proved guilty. But I think Milgram goes more with you realize your guilt. Like, somehow you did it without knowing, then later you realize, and then you do this and this to be cleaned from it.
But if it's what happens in Leviticus 5, it seems to me, is that the level of guilt, you can't put levels of guilt on it. The realization that you are unclean and that you have really, I don't know,
or you've,
lied,
messed,
or just
you've messed with holy things, you've dealt with holy things inappropriately.
Yeah, or you've just messed with
yeah.
the truth, or you've just, for your own sake,
yeah.
it was better to say, well, I didn't see him take that. But, you know, it's not
mm-hmm.
sort of mammoth.
Right.
But it's just that, because coming back to what Nick says about the purity laws, this is to do the ceremonial laws, I mean,
mm-hmm.
they're set there to really give you a sort of human standard.
Right.
I mean, we move
well,
on to
they're
the...
They're set to show you that God is different from humanity. So these things, humans are impure, God is pure.
Right.
So it's like you have to be this certain ceremonial state to be in God's presence. But look in verse 4, back in Leviticus 5, because leaving this ceremonial stuff, again, it goes back to this concept of swearing. Notice it says, levate bisfataim, for good or for ill. Levate bisfataim, to pronounce with your mouth. And this is really interesting, because where else does this little phrase occur?
Isn't that God tells levan, not the same thing, good or bad?
No,
does it use levate
no.
bisfataim?
What is that?
Bil'am says I can't say anything good or bad. But the word levate that I'm thinking about is what is it? Psalm 106? I think it's Psalm 106. It's one of the historical psalms where it's going through all the things that happened in the desert and recapping things. And it mentions how Moses spoke rashly and therefore he was not allowed in the promised land. Because, like, you know, why didn't Moses get to come in the promised land? There's different options. So I'm like, oh, because he beat the rock and didn't do this. What happened in Numbers 20 to disqualify him? What really was a sin? Was it that he beat the rock? And so Psalm 106 says it's because he spoke rashly. And it uses this term, levate bisfataim. And it's also, this term also comes up with oaths that people make with God. I don't remember, I didn't actually write down all the references for these, but you can track them down.
Can you write up the
levate bisfataim?
I don't think it's in Psalm 106.
No? Well, that's what happens when you go by your memory.
Moses, 106.
Oh, what did you hear?
160, sorry.
Psalms, well, there's no 160, so...
16.
Oh, 116, yeah.
106 or 116?
No. 106. 106. Okay. 33? They made his spirit bitter and he spoke rashly. Vaivate bisfatav. So did he curse them? Did he make an oath? Because the words in Numbers 20 aren't a curse. They're, hey, do we have to bring forth water from this rock? So it's more like he's denying God's part in the miracle. But here it's saying he spoke some rash words. So either in the act of his anger, he spoke things he shouldn't have said. But in other contexts, this phrase is related to taking an oath. But also, it's usually in the context of taking an oath too quickly. So the same broad category of speaking something you shouldn't say.
What about Jethro's daughter? Is that the same thing?
That Jethro. It wasn't his daughter. It was Jethro.
Jethro took an oath rashly.
You're talking about Jephthah.
Yiftah, not Jethro.
Sorry.
I can't remember.
Jephthah.
Yiftah. Yeah, I can't remember if it says levate bisfatav there.
I know because I live on Jephthah Street.
That's right.
The horrible street to live on.
I think Psalms 106, the people who are, the psalmist is saying, the ones who are guilty are the people, not Moses himself. If you read the first few verses before 33, it's talking about they didn't do this, they broke into anger.
He's blaming the people for making him too angry. But who did it? Vaivate. That's one person.
Right.
He did it.
Yeah.
Moses spoke rashly.
Yeah.
So you could say it's a give and a take. You know, the people made him too angry, but he's still the one ultimately responsible for what comes out of his mouth.
Because in Exodus 20, the people make Moses, because you go and talk to God on our behalf. So Moses becomes the representative of the people. So
sure. As a prophet, he represents the people to God and God to the people,
The people chose him to be the spokespiece.
Okay.
So it's actually the people's sin. It's not Moses' sin.
Then the people would have been cut out from the promised land and not Moses.
They did. They didn't go into
the
promised
land. But also Moses.
Yeah.
Moses did too. So he had to be involved in the sin.
Because he is with the people and he's now representing the people. So he can't. In fact, what was said in Numbers 20 is that because you and Aaron did not believe me. There's no way Moses did not believe God. He believed God all the way. But why?
The first time round, he just has to strike the rock, right? The second time round, he's told to do the same thing, and he basically loses it. He's just mad. I don't know if he's mad at God or mad at the people.
And I think the problem is, it's not that he didn't believe God, it's that he didn't represent the belief in God to the people. Because when he's about to strike the rock, he says, should we bring water out for you? and then he strikes it. So it makes it look like he and Aaron are doing this for them and not God. And that part, he's not being faithful to God or showing that it's God doing it. That's what I think it means by believing in God, to be faithful to represent God to the people.
Well, I would see it a different way.
Okay.
If you do a comparison, you just do a word search with the word believe, before Sinai and after Sinai. Before Sinai, it says the people believe, they believe, they believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sinai 19, Exodus 19,
yeah.
It says go up the mountain so that they will hear your words and they may believe you. So it's like a test.
Mm-hmm.
And they failed. And then after that, all the words, you do a word search of belief after Sinai, they did not believe. They did not believe. They did not believe. And Numbers 20 falls under one of the, they did not believe. So
okay.
God, because Moses was the representative of the people, he too, unfortunately, was
tied to their faith. Well, okay, you're trying to exonerate Moses from any responsibility. Like Psalm 106 kind of goes like that, but I don't know, God's pretty fair, and I don't think that he would have punished Moses. Like, for instance, Joshua and the spies. Joshua and Caleb got to enter the promised land, even though the other 10 people didn't believe. So the fact that Moses and Aaron died outside the promised land shows that they were somehow actually guilty.
Well, my point here is that the key to go inside the promised land is belief. Belief.
Sure,
God.
Belief, yes.
And they did not believe. Joshua and Caleb did believe,
mm-hmm.
and that's why they went in.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting motif
yeah.
to follow. The
yeah,
whole belief.
And in fact,
throughout. I don't know if it's as cut and dry as you're laying out, but there is definitely that broad stroke picture there. And it's calling everybody to believe. But I do want to get to, oh, we're out of time.
Mm-hmm.
Zechariah 5.
Say something,
actually, we don't really have time. So I just want to leave this. For those who read Zechariah 5, it's the vision about this woman representing evil. And I think the key tie-in to the verse here is Allah. This word Allah that we've been looking at. And now I can't even find it.
5:3.
5:3 is just the curse
Allah.
That's going out.
Yeah.
Verse 3.
There it is. Zot ha'ala hayotzet al pnei chol ha'aretz. So that word that's translated curse is the Allah. And again, it's in the context where there's some kind of a flying scroll. It's like a very tangible thing that's going out and can rest on someone and bring judgment. And you also have the context of being clean from the curse if you're innocent, or not clean it, or not clean from it if you're dirty, or if you're not innocent. And also in the context of stealing, which is one of the contexts in Leviticus 5. And if you notice in verse 4, this Allah actually comes and it rests on the house of the thief, and it'll destroy it. Even the physical house, the boards and the stones. There you go. His hat's burning. So I think part of the connection here is also secret sins, because these are sins that people could get away with. And I lean to it not being a legal transaction that's forcing them to see they're guilty. I lean towards them understanding or admitting that they're guilty. And then in order to be forgiven, they bring their offerings to the Lord. and he forgives them. And they are asked to bring back whatever it is they stole or a lost item they just appropriated to themselves. They bring back an equivalent worth plus a fifth, plus 20% more to the person who was the victim. And so you can ponder those things as you go downstairs. And you can put them into practice. I know as Christians sometimes aren't very practical. We have it all between us and God. Oh, God, forgive me, I did this wrong thing. But we never actually try to physically make up for it to the person we wronged. I shouldn't say we never, but we often just stop there. And I like in this context that God forgives, and the person is still required as part of that process to repay the person he wronged. So Shabbat Shalom, and make your way downstairs. The worship service is about to start.